to a new file called File 2. Let's put those files in a directory. So we'll use the make directory command, mkdir, dir. So we'll create a directory called dir. Next, use the cp command, cp, file 1, file 2, dir slash. This will move the files into that directory, which you can confirm with lsdir. Now we're going to delete those files from that directory with the command rmdir/*. This will only remove the contents of the subdirectory dir, which are file 1 and file 2. Now, if you put in the command cp file 1 file 2 dir and then cp-i file 1 file 2, it will prompt you to ask if you want to overwrite file 2, yes or no. So if you say no, it will tell you it was not overwritten. Next, if you enter the command cp-r dir dir2, it will copy the directory dir into a new directory dir2, as well as the contents file 1 and file 2, which you can confirm with the ls command lsdir2. So let's try this. If you type in cp-dir dir3, it will actually return an error, since without the dash -r command, it cannot copy a directory, and it will tell you dir is a directory not copied. So let's fix that. If you type in mkdir dir3 to create the dir3 directory, now, you're going to move the other two directories within that directory using the command cp-r dir dir2 dir3. This will move those first two directories underneath dir3, as well as all of their contents. So if you type in ls dir3, you will see two directories, dir and dir2. If you use the tree command on dir3, it will show you dir and dir2 as its subdirectories, each of those containing file 1 and file 2. Moving and renaming files. The way to rename files or directories in Linux is to use the mv command for move. The mv command moves files from one location to another. This can be used to relocate files or directories, or it can be used to rename them also. MV source destination. This will move files or directories. If the destination is a directory, that source will be moved into the destination. Otherwise, the source will be renamed to the destination. MV-I source and destination. This runs MV in interactive mode. If the destination file already exists, MV will prompt you before it overwrites the file. Let's take a look at some examples of this. They should make it clear how the MV command behaves in various situations. Within a given directory, if you type in ls-f, it would return dir/dir2/dir3/file1/file2. These are the contents of that directory, indicating that the first three are directories and the last two are files. Now, if you use the command mv dir first dir and then run that ls command again, you will see that dir slash has been renamed to first dir slash and moved to the end of the line, since the ls command defaults to listing things in alphabetical order. Next, if you use the command mv file1 file1.renamed and use the ls command again, you will see that it has changed the name of file1. Now we're going to move that file into a directory using the command mv file1.renamed/dir/. If you run the ls command again, you will see that file1.renamed has disappeared from the listing, because it is no longer in that given directory. But if you run ls -f/dir/, it will show you the contents of /dir, which are file1, file1.renamed, and file2. As we list the contents of these files using the cat command, you'll see the contents have not changed. For example, cat /dir/file1. It returns the text in the file. This text started out in file 1. You could do cat /dir/file2, and it will return the contents of that file, saying this text started out in file 2. Now, if we use the command mv /dir/file1/dir/file2, and then do a cat command on file 2, cat /dir/file2, it will return this text started out in file 1, because you have used the move command to overwrite file 2 with the contents of file 1. Now, if we repeat the command ls -f/dir/, you would see that file 1 has disappeared, leaving only file1.renamed and file 2. Now, if we were to do mv -i /file1.renamed /dir/file2, it would prompt us if we want to overwrite file 2 with the contents of file1.renamed. In this example, a directory was renamed with mv -dir/dir. Next, a file was renamed with mv file1 file1.renamed. Next, file1.renamed was relocated to the /dir directory with the mv file1.renamed /dir/command. A file was overwritten with the command mv /dir/file1/dir/file2. Now remember, if you want to be prompted before a file is overwritten, use the -i option within your command. Sorting data. You have already seen the sort command in use. In its simplest form, it sorts lines of text alphabetically. Here are some examples of how that command is used. Sort, and then the file name. This will sort the text in a file. Sort -k, uppercase F, and then the file name. This sorts by key. The uppercase F we mentioned following -k is the field number. Sort -r, file name. This sorts in reverse order. Sort -u, file name, sorts the text in the file, removing duplicate lines. We're going to play around a little bit with a file called More Secrets, containing Bob's credentials for logging into Facebook. So if you were to cat the file More Secrets using cat More Secrets, you get a nice little table with the tag credentials, the site facebook.com, the username Bob, his password a B, and more tags saying credentials, identical to the first line. If you were to use the sort command, sort More Secrets, it would list everything in alphabetical order by the first letter of each line. So the password would come first, followed by the site, followed by the two identical lines of tags, and then the user. Now, if we use the command sort -u More Secrets, it will list exactly as it did before in alphabetical order, but one of the two tags lines will be removed since they are identical. We can sort it even further by doing sort -ru More Secrets, and this will list everything in reverse alphabetical order, with the username coming first, followed by the tags, the site, and the password. A final option is sort -u -k2 More Secrets, This will sort everything by the second column, which is the actual contents of those things. So the password will be listed first, AB, followed by the user, Bob, the tags, credentials, and the site, facebook.com. So it's ordered as ABCF. Creating a collection of files. If you want to bundle a group of files and/or directories together in an archive, you can use the tar command. You may want to create a copy or backup of a group of files. You may have several files you want to transfer at once or as a set. In these situations, tar can help. You would use it in the following order: tar-C or X or T, F, tar file, and then the pattern. This will create, extract, or list contents of a tar archive using a particular pattern, if it's supplied. Note that tar does not actually require a dash to precede its arguments. Traditionally, the hyphen is excluded, but tar will still work with it. If you see tar-cf-file.tar, it is the same as tar-cf-file.tar. Here is a look at some of the most commonly used tar options. C. Create a tar archive. X. Extract files from the archive. T. Display the table of contents or list the archive. V. Causes tar to be verbose. F. And then a file name, the tar archive file to perform these operations against. Here's an example where tar is used to create an archive, list the contents of an archive, and extract the contents. So we will create an archive using the command tar-cf-tps.tar/tps-reports/. This will create a tar called tps.tar, containing the contents of the directory tps-reports. Now, if you do tar-tf-tps.tar, it will list the directory tps-reports and the contents of that directory, salesreport.txt and coversheet.doc. Now we're going to extract the contents. First, we're going to switch to another directory, cd/tmp, or temp. Now we would use the command tar-xf/home/bob/tps.tar. This will extract all of the contents into the temp directory, creating a subdirectory called tps-reports. Now if we run the ls command, ls-tps-reports/, we will see that coversheet.doc and salesreport.txt are now in that subdirectory. If you would like to see the files that are getting placed into the archive or extracted from the archive, you would use -v to enable verbose mode, as in the following command: tar-cvf-miscellaneous.tar/sec*tps-reports. It will list every file it's copying into miscellaneous.tar as it works. Compressing files to save space. Here are some common commands used to compress files within a Linux system: gzip and the file name. This compresses the file. The resulting compressed file is named file.gz. gunzip file. This uncompresses files. gzcat or zcat. This will concatenate and print compressed files. You can use the command du to display how much space is used by a file. The command du would estimate the file usage. du-k would display sizes in kilobytes. du-h would display sizes in a human-readable format, such as 1.2 megabytes, 3.7 gigabytes, etc. Here are a couple quick examples that demonstrate how to compress and uncompress files. If we have a file called data, and we run the command du-k data, we will see that the file is 15,360 kilobytes. Now we would run gzip data. This will create a compressed file called data.gz. Now if you run du-k data.gz, you will see that the compressed archive is only 26 kilobytes. Now if you were to do ls data star on this directory, you would only see data.gz, since the original file was compressed into this archive. If you entered the command gunzip data.gz, and then run that ls command again, you will see that the original file data is back. So let's look at another one. du-k miscellaneous.tar. This is an archive that is 10 kilobytes in size. Now, if you run gzip on miscellaneous.tar and run the ls command again, you will see that it has been compressed further into the file miscellaneous.tar.gz. Compressing archives. In modern versions of the tar command, gzip compression is built in. If you want to create, extract, or list the contents of a compressed archive, use the -z argument. As a matter of convention, compressed tar files will end in either .tar.gz or .tgz. Here's an example of how this would look. If you entered the command tar zcf tps.tgz tps reports, and then run the ls command *.tgz, you will see tps.tgz. Now if you run tar ztf tps.tgz, it will show you that the TPS reports directory and its contents, salesreport.txt and coversheet.doc, have been archived within it. If you run across an older version of tar without gzip compression built in, you can use pipes to create compressed archives. When a hyphen or dash is used in place of a file name, that means to use standard output. When running the command tar cf dash and then the pattern, this will create an archive of whatever the pattern is and send the output to standard output, which is normally your screen. If you follow the command with a pipe, that standard output will be used as the input for the next command following the pipe. To force gunzip to send its output to standard out, use the -c argument. With this in mind, here's an example of how you can create, list, and extract a compressed archive using tar, gzip, and pipes. If you entered the command tar cf dash tps reports pipe gzip greater than sign tps.tgz, it will convert the contents of the TPS reports directory into that file tps.tgz. If you wanted to see the contents of that particular archive, you could use a command like gunzip -c tps.tgz pipe tar tf dash, and it would list the contents of tps.tgz on your screen. Now if you were to change directories, cd slash temp, and run the command gunzip dash c slash home slash bob slash tps.tgz pipe tar xf dash, this would extract the contents of the archive into the temp directory. So then you could run an ls command and get the directory tps reports and its contents coversheet.doc and salesreport.txt. Redirection. You've already learned how to redirect output from one command and send it as input to another one using pipes. In this previous example, You saw another way to redirect output using the greater than sign. Let's take a closer look at I/O redirection, with I/O standing for input and output. There are three default types of input and output. They are standard input, standard output, and standard error. By default, standard input comes from the keyboard, and standard output and standard error are displayed to the screen. Each one of these I/O types is given a file descriptor. File descriptors are just numbers that represent open files. For humans, it is easier to reference files by name, but it is easier for computers to reference them by number. You may be thinking, my keyboard isn't a file, nor is my screen. On one level, that is true, but on another level, it is not. Linux represents practically everything as a file. This abstraction allows you to do powerful things, like take the standard output of one command that would normally be displayed to your screen and use it as input to another command. It's easier to run cat file.txt pipe sort than it is to type the entire contents of file.txt as the input to the sort command. To demonstrate this concept, run sort, type in some text, and press Ctrl-D on a blank line. Here's how that might look. If you typed in the command sort, and then you have four lines, DDDD, A, CCC, BB, and then on the fifth line you hit Ctrl-D, it would resort those lines in alphabetical order, so you would get A, BB, CCC, DDDD. Now say those lines were in a file called file.txt. If you typed in cat file.txt, it would display those four lines for you. Now if you were to append the sort command using a pipe, cat file.txt pipe sort, it would sort those lines in alphabetical order. You can see how this might save you time. The three primary I/O types are standard input, abbreviated as STDIN, with a file descriptor number of 0. Standard output, or STDOUT, with a file descriptor number of 1. And standard error, or STDERR, with a file descriptor number of 2. You use the greater than sign to redirect output, and the less than sign to redirect input. The explicit way of using redirection is to provide a file descriptor number. However, if it is omitted, then file descriptor 0 is assumed for input redirection and 1 for output redirection. Greater than symbol. This redirects standard output to a file, overwriting or truncating any existing contents of the file. If no file exists, it will create one. A double greater than sign. This redirects standard output to a file and appends to any existing contents. If no file exists, it will create one. Less than symbol. This redirects input from a file to the command preceding the less than sign. In the directory /opt/apache, if you were to run the following command, ls dash lowercase l uppercase f /opt/apache, it would list the contents of that given directory. Now, if we were to use that command, but on the end add a greater than symbol, such as this, ls dash l uppercase f /opt/apache greater than sign files.txt, it would create a file called files.txt. And if you use the cat command on files.txt, you would see the contents of that directory listed exactly as a text file. Now, if you type the command ls-l-f/opt/apache double greater than sign files.txt and run the cat command again, you will see that it has done the exact same thing twice in the text file, since the double greater than sign appends your output to the end of an existing file. Now, if you wanted to, you could run sort \files.txt, and it would display the contents of files.txt in alphabetical order on your screen. In the previous example, ls-l/opt/apache > files.txt is the same as ls-l/opt/apache 1 > files.txt. Also, sort < files.txt is the same as sort 0 < files.txt. You do not use a space between the file descriptor number and the redirection operator. The file descriptor must immediately precede the redirection operator, otherwise it will be interpreted as another item on the command line. Input and output redirection can be combined. The following example will show files.txt being redirected as input for the sort command. The output of the sort command is then redirected to the sorted_files.txt file. So if you were to type in the command sort < files.txt > sorted_files.txt, and then run the cat command on the new file, you would see the end of the previous example, where the files are listed twice in alphabetical order. Standard error. When a program encounters an error, it reports its findings to standard error. File descriptor 1 is for standard output, 2 is for standard error. Remember that file descriptor 1 is the default file descriptor for output redirection. This can mean that not all of the output generated by a program is captured by default. Here's an example. In this particular directory, if you typed in the command ls, here, not here, it would return an error command to the screen that says ls, not here, no such file or directory, as well as the actual content here. Now, if you were to put the command ls, here, not here, > out to create a new file, it would give you the error command ls, not here, but it would also create the file out containing the contents here, which you can confirm with the command cat out. Now you could also type in the command ls here not here 2 > out.err. If you were to run a cat command on out.err, it would give you the error message ls not here, no such file directory, as part of that file. So, you could combine the two of these with the command ls here not here 1 > out 2 > out.err. This will output the valid file here into the file out, and output the error message from not here into out.err. If you were paying attention, you would notice that when using the greater than symbol, the error message was displayed to the screen and not redirected to the out file. To redirect the error messages, you had to explicitly specify file descriptor 2 with 2 > You can send standard output to one file while sending standard error to another file, as we just did. You can use this to your advantage by having one file that contains known good output and another file that you can examine for errors. If you want to capture both standard output and standard error, you would use 2 > ampersand 1. Normally with redirection, a file follows the redirection operator. If you want to use a file descriptor instead of a file name, use the ampersand symbol, which is the and sign. So instead of redirecting standard error to a file, 2 > out.err, redirect it to standard output, 2 > ampersand 1. If you omit the ampersand, 1 will be treated as a file named 1. Building on our previous example, if you were to run the following command, ls here not here, greater than symbol, out dot both, 2 greater than, ampersand 1, this will create a file called out dot both. If you run the cat command on that file, you will see it list the error message first, followed by the file name here second. That command means send the standard output of ls here not here to the file named out.both and append standard error to standard output. Since standard error is redirected to standard output and standard output is redirected to out.both, all of the output will be written to out.both. Null device / dev / null. Redirect output to nowhere. If you want to ignore output, you can send it to the null device, dev null. The null device is a special file that throws away whatever is fed to it. You may hear people refer to it as the bitbucket. If you do not want to see errors on your screen, and you do not want to save them to a file, you can redirect them to dev null. Here's an example. ls here not here 2 greater than / dev / null. This will only return the result here. Now, if you were to do the command ls here not here greater than / dev / null 2 greater than ampersand 1, you would get nothing in return, not even an error message, since it set the entire contents of the command to dev null. For more information on file descriptors, here documents, the null device or redirection, visit our online companion at www.linuxtrainingacademy.com/LFB. Transferring and copying files. You already know how to copy files from one location to another on the same system using the cp command. But what if you want to copy files from your local workstation to a Linux server or between Linux servers? For that, you can use scp or sftp. scp is secure copy, and SFTP is SSH File Transfer Protocol. Sometimes SFTP is referred to as Secure File Transfer Protocol. Both are extensions of the Secure Shell Protocol. This means that if you have SSH key authentication configured for SSH, it will also work with SCP and SFTP. In order to use SCP or SFTP, you need a client. Mac and Linux come with SCP and SFTP command line utilities. If you're running Windows, you can use the PuTTY Secure Copy Client, pscp.exe, and the PuTTY Secure File Transfer Client, psftp.exe. Command line utilities aren't your only option. There are also graphical clients for each platform as well. Some, like FileZilla, run on Windows, Linux, and Mac, while others only run on one platform, like WinSCP for Windows. For the command line usage, you would use something like SCP, source, and then the destination. Obviously, this copies your source files to your destination. SFTP, username at host, allows you to connect to the host as a username beginning a secure file transfer session. If you're looking for a more interactive experience where you can examine the local and remote file systems, use SFTP. With SCP, you need to know what files you want to transfer before using the command. Using SCP, you can copy from your local system to a remote system, from a remote system to your local system, or from one remote system to another remote system. Here are some quick examples of how that would look. Say Bob is on his local Linux server. He could use the command scp test.txt linux server 1 :// slash. This would copy the file test.txt from his local directory to the home directory on the remote Linux Server 1. If you use the command scp Linux Server 1 --test.txt, he would be copying the test file from the remote Linux server to his home directory on the local server. If he wanted to transfer between two remote systems, he would use a command like this: scp Linux Server 1 --test.txt, Linux Server 2 --temp/testcopy.txt. SCP and SFTP aren't the only ways to transfer files to remote systems. Sometimes FTP, or File Transfer Protocol, is enabled. In such cases, you can use the built-in FTP command on Linux and Mac, and a graphical client like WinSCP for Windows. Just be aware that FTP is not using a secure transfer protocol like SCP and SFTP. This means that your login credentials are sent in plain text over the network. Also, the files that you upload and download are not encrypted either. If given the choice between SCP, SFTP, or FTP, always use the secure options of SCP and SFTP. If you attempt to connect to a server where FTP is not enabled, you will see a connection refused error message. For more information on FTP and SFTP programs for Windows, Mac, and Linux, and their operations, visit our online companion at www.linuxtrainingacademy.com/LFB. Welcome back to Shell. Customizing the prompt. As you have seen in the Welcome to Shell chapter, default prompts can vary from system to system. No matter what shell you are using, you can customize your prompt by setting an environment variable. For shells like Bash, KSH, and SH, the environment variable PS1 is used to set the primary prompt string. The shells CSH, TCSH, and ZSH use the prompt environment variable. The format string you place in the environment variable determines the look and feel of your prompt. Each shell uses different format strings, so consult the documentation for the shell that you are using. Let's take a look at customizing the Bash prompt, since Bash is the most popular default shell for user accounts on Linux systems. These are some of the commonly used formatting string options for Bash. For a complete list, refer to the man page. /D. This would display the date in weekday, month, date format. /H. This will display the host name up to the first dot. /H. This will display the entire host name. /N. This will create a new line for the prompt. /T. This displays the current time in 24-hour, hour-hour, minute-minute, second-second format. /T displays the current time in the same format but in 12-hour form. /@. The current time is displayed in 12-hour AM-PM format. /A. The current time is displayed in 24-hour, hour-hour, minute-minute format. /U. The username of the current user. /W. The current working directory, with the home directory abbreviated with a tilde. /W. The base name of the current working directory, again with the home directory abbreviated with a tilde. $. If the effective user ID is 0, a pound sign is shown, otherwise a dollar sign is shown. To make your customized shell prompt persist between logins, add the PS1 value to your personal initialization files. Personal initialization files are commonly referred to as dot files, since they begin with a dot or a period. For example, you could enter the command echo, and then in single quotes, export PS1 equals, and then in double quotes, brackets, $\U$\H$\W$\ (close brackets\$$\, close double quotes, and close single quotes, \\tilde\\dot\bash_profile. Creating aliases. If you find yourself typing the same command over and over again, you can create a shortcut for it called an alias. An alias can be thought of as a text expander. Creating aliases for commands that are really long is also a common practice. For example, if you type ls-l frequently, you may want to abbreviate it to ll. As a matter of fact, this alias often comes predefined on many Linux distributions. You would use the alias command in this format: alias name equals value. This will list or create aliases. If no arguments are provided, the current list of aliases are displayed. You would use name equaling value to create a new alias. Here's another quick example. Say you like the grep command, but you want it to auto-color all of the results. You can create an alias using the command alias grep equals, and then in single quotes, grep --color=auto, close quote. Then, when you type in grep, it will follow this command exactly. You can even use aliases to fix common typing errors. If you find yourself typing grep as grpe when you intend to type grep, create an alias by doing this: alias grpe equals grep in single quotes. Aliases can be created to make your work environment similar to that of another platform. For instance, in Windows, cls clears the screen, but in Linux, the equivalent command is clear. If you're coming from an HP UX background, you are most likely familiar with the command bdf, which displays disk usage. On Linux, a very similar command is df. You could create these shortcuts to help you feel more at home, such as alias cls equals single quotes clear, end quote, or alias bdf equals open quote df, close quote. Note that if you were to log out and log back in, these aliases would be lost. To make them persist between sessions, add them to one of your personal initialization files or dot files, such as .bash_profile. The downside to creating several aliases is that when you are on a system that does not have your aliases, you might feel lost. If you want to be able to work effectively on any system that you have access to, keep your alias usage to a minimum. Another way to handle this situation is to copy your configuration files to each system that you work on. Interactive versus non-interactive sessions. The shell behaves in slightly different ways when you log on interactively versus when you just connect to run a single command. The contents of .profile or .bashprofile are only executed for interactive sessions. If you're not aware of this subtle difference, it may leave you scratching your head as to why something works perfectly when you log in and type a command versus when you just SSH in to run that same command. For example, if you define an alias for LL in your .bashprofile, it will work during an interactive session, but it will not be available during a non-interactive session. You can save yourself some hassle by making your interactive and non-interactive sessions behave the same. To do this, configure .bashprofile to reference .bashrc and put all of your configuration in .bashrc. You can read in the contents of another file by using the source command or a dot operator. For example, source file name. This will read and execute commands from a given file name and return. Any variables created or modified in the file name will remain available after the script completes. Dot, and then the file name. This operates the same as source, and then the file name. A brief example might be, you could program your .bash profile with an if-then statement, which states that if the default is .bashrc, then the source for bash profile should be bashrc. Then, when you edit the .bashrc file, that is where you can put all of your aliases, your prompt definitions, etc., so that there would be no difference between interactive and non-interactive sessions. In some files, when you edit them, you might notice the octothorpe, followed by some very human-like text in both the bash profile and bashrc files. Any text that follows an octothorpe is ignored by the shell. This is a very common pattern that not only works for shells, but also for several computer programming languages. This construct allows comments and annotations to be used without affecting the execution of a program or script. The octothorpe is also known as a hash, square, pound sign, or number sign. This symbol precedes comments. Throughout the book, you'll most likely hear us comment to it as a pound sign. Shell history. The shell keeps a record of the commands you have previously executed. Bash keeps its history in memory for the current session and in the .bash_history file so that it can be recalled during future sessions. Other shells may use .history, .zsh_history, or other similarly named files. Having access to your shell history is extremely useful because it allows you to quickly repeat commands. This can save you time, save keystrokes, prevent you from making mistakes by running a previously known good command, and generally speed up your workflow. History. Display a list of commands in the shell history. Exclamation point N. Repeat command line number N, where N is the number you specify. Double exclamation point. Repeat the previous command line. Exclamation point string. Repeat the most recent command starting with whatever string you input. As an example, if you ran the command history, it would return three lines. The first line would be the command ls. The second line is diff secret, secret.bak, and the third line is history. Now, if you were to type the command exclamation point 1, it would rerun ls. If you were to type in echo $shell all in uppercase, you would get the path /bin/bash. If you were to do a double exclamation point, it would rerun that command and give you the same result. If you did exclamation point D, it would run the command that contains the letter D within the string. So in this case, it would run diff secret secret.bak and give you the passwords from Facebook that we covered in an earlier chapter. With the exclamation mark history expansion syntax, you can rerun a command by number. In the above example, the first command in the history was executed with exclamation point 1. If you wanted to execute the second command, you would type in exclamation point 2. Another convenient shortcut is exclamation point dash n, where n is the previous command you wish to execute. So if you wanted to execute the second to last command, you would type exclamation point dash 2. Since double exclamation point repeats the most recent command, it is the same as exclamation point dash 1. By default, Bash retains 500 commands in your shell history. This is controlled by the environment variable hist size, all caps. If you want to increase this number, add export hist size equals 1000 or something similar to your personal initialization files. Control R. Reverse search. Search for commands in your shell history. You can actually search for commands in your history. For example, if you have the command find /var/temp-type f in your shell history, you could find it by typing Control R FI Enter. Control R initiates the reverse search and displays the search prompt. FI is the search string, and Enter executes the command that was found. You do not have to search for the start of the string. You could very well have searched for var, temp, tmp, or type. Tab completion. Another way to increase your efficiency at the shell is by using tab completion. After you start typing a command, you can hit the tab key to invoke completion. Tab attempts to automatically complete partially typed commands. If there are multiple commands that begin with the string that precedes the tab, those commands will be displayed. You can continue to type and press tab again. When there is only one possibility remaining, pressing the tab key will complete the command. For example, typing who and tabbing twice results in two possible options, who and who am I. But if you were to type whoa, hit the tab key and then hit enter, that would result in the system running the who am I command, which would then reply with Bob. Tab completion not only works on commands, but it also works on files and directories. If you have files that start with a common prefix, tab will expand the common component. For example, if you have two files named file1.txt and file2.txt, typing cat f and then the tab key will expand the line to cat file. You can then continue typing or press tab twice to list the possible expansions. Typing cat f tab 2 tab will expand to cat file2.txt. After you experiment a little bit with tab completion, it will soon become second nature. Shell command line